Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Mark Strand. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his collection of poetry, A Blizzard of One. He has been, for many years, one of my favorite American poets. From the time his book, Reasons for Moving, appeared, to Darker, I've been a great admirer. And the book, Blizzard of One, has recently appeared in paperback, accompanied by the appearance in hardcover of a book of essays on poetic invention called The Weather of Words, published by Alfred A. Knopf. Now, often as not, I find myself saying things before I hear what I've said, and I found myself describing Mark Strand as a poet of sepulchral lunacy. And then I found myself thinking, well, he is, isn't he? And just to prove it, I asked him to begin by reading a poem called Some Last Words. Mark Strand.
Thank you, Michael. Some last words. One, it is easier for a needle to pass through a camel than for a poor man to enter a woman of means. Just go to the graveyard and ask around. Two, eventually, you slip outside, letting the door bang shut on your latest thought. What was it, anyway? Just go to the graveyard and ask around. Three. Negligence is the perfume I love. Oh, Fedora, Fedora, if you want any, just go to the graveyard and ask around. Four. The bones of the buffalo, the rabbit at sunset, the wind and its double, the tree, the town. Just go to the graveyard and ask around. Five. If you think good things are on their way and the world will improve, don't hold your breath. Just go to the graveyard and ask around. Six. You over there, why do you ask if this is the Valley of Limitless Blue and if we are its prisoners? Just go to the graveyard and ask around. Seven. Life is a dream that is never recalled when the sleeper awakes. If this is beyond you, magnificent one, just go to the graveyard and ask around.
Mark Strand, reading Some Last Words from A Blizzard of One. Now, that tone of a kind of, what, giddy seriousness? Can you describe it?
Well, you're right. It's a kind of lunacy, a lunatic voice, but, you know, it is sepulchral. I intended the poem to be funny. I thought I'd get off with a fast start, you know, with the biblical pastiche at the beginning. But it's pretty hard to find things as well known that you can sort of undermine as easily. So I quickly ran out of gas. I had that and saved, well, the rest of the poem came later. I didn't write it all at once. I kept writing little, I may have had 30 such three-line stanzas, and I merely picked the best, strung them together, and I had some last words.
That's a very interesting idea to me, because I know that your poems have not only repetitions, but repetitive processes of composition. Mm-hmm. Are these sort of talismanic acts of some kind? Is there something?
Well, I mean, what holds them together?
What holds them together, and why do you find them attractive to come on a formula and then use it?
You know, I'm not sure how attractive I find them. I certainly found them attractive enough to include them in the poem initially. I liked the line, just go to the graveyard and ask around. I thought that was a real find, and I wanted to use it as often as I could. So I used it as a refrain, and I found other lines that would go with it. Not the same kind of lines, but so that in each of these tercets, the tone would vary a bit, and the repeated line would come in a slightly different way, so there'd be some variation in the poem.
In that way, making it sort of like a villanelle, which the book is full of, yes?
There are a couple in there, yeah, villanelles. It's a lot easier to do than a villanelle, because you just, you know, every three lines you think of another two lines and then stick the refrain line on. But a villanelle, you have to stick to the rhymes, you know.
Let's hear one of them.
Okay. I wrote a couple of villanelles based on the paintings of Giorgio di Chirico, the famous Italian surrealist who did his best work, I believe, and I think many others believe, between 1911 and 1918. I'll read you one about a painting of his called The Disquieting Muses, of which, incidentally, there are 19. He kept doing the same painting again and again because so many people liked it. Boredom sets in first, and then despair. One tries to brush it off. It only grows. Something about the silence of the square. Something is wrong. Something about the air. Its color. About the light. The way it glows. Boredom sets in first, and then despair. The muses in their fluted evening wear, their faces blank, might lead one to suppose something about the silence of the square. Something about the building standing there. But no, they have no purpose but to pose. Boredom sets in first, and then despair. What happens after that? One doesn't care. What brought one here? The desire to compose something about the silence of the square, or something else of which one's not aware. Life itself, perhaps. Who really knows? Boredom sets in first, and then despair. Something about the silence of the square.
Could you speak a bit more about di Chirico, first of all?
Well, di Chirico was born in Greece, went to Italy, went to Paris, friendly with Apollinaire, who, it is said, titled his paintings for him. He was the brother of Mario Savinio, composer, essayist, painter,
novelist.
The two of them were quite something. But then di Chirico underwent a change in about 1918. He shifted his style. He started doing copies of his earlier paintings because they were in such demand. And he became, you know, an imitator of himself and then a creator of, you know, yards and yards of kitsch. Now, there was a period in the 80s when everybody thought his kitsch was better than his surrealist work. They were wrong.
Oh, that was crazy. That was the period of that show at the Museum of Modern Art.
Yeah, I mean, the painting's not even worthy of perfume ads.
But there is something, to return to it, about the repetitive gesture.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a very self-conscious choice on my part to use the villanelle because I attempted to reproduce some of the repetitions that exist in di Chirico. Always in di Chirico, you have a tower, a boat, a train, smokestack, you know, flags waving, a huge piazza in which two small figures cast a long shadow, many arcades.
You always leave out the artichoke.
Well, there's only one painting with the artichoke. Actually, more paintings with bananas in them. The artichoke painting I did write a villanelle about, and that's at the Art Institute in Chicago. But I don't consider that villanelle quite as good as the one I just read.
Because the a painter that I always think of in relation to you, not only in relation to you, but of course in relation to your friend, the painter William Bailey, mm-hmm. is Giorgio Morandi, mm-hmm. a painter whose life work, it seems, is in the repetition of a small cast of jugs and bottles, which yeah. appear rearranged in each painting in the most beautiful and mysterious pastel colors.
Well, not always pastel, but, I mean, sometimes there are blacks and dark browns in there, but never garish bright colors.
but the strange stillness of still life, made stranger still by the constant rearranging of the same figures, it has the feeling of a villanelle, but also of, as you suggest about de Chirico, boredom, a chosen limitation, a desire to mystify by doing the same thing again and again. And in Bailey's work, to my mind, at least when I see it, it's doubly mystifying because in the same way that the Aeneid might reproduce the Odyssey, Bailey reproduces Morandi.
See, well, I disagree. I think they both paint pots and utensils, but Bailey's is, I mean, Bailey's are so entirely different from Morandi's. For one thing, Bailey's are monumental, grand. They are disposed horizontally, and they are cenotaphic, finally, cool, existing in a realm beyond the human, perfect. Whereas Morandi's are tentative. Instead of being horizontal, they seem to gather crowd into the center or at the edge of a table. So they exhibit a kind of frailty that I associate with human beings. Bailey's don't exhibit that sort of frailty.
They're armored in a way.
They're armored.
Yeah.
And I think that the verticality also, which is the dominant position of Morandi's bottles, I mean, they're standing up, gives them an added frailty. And also between Morandi's objects, there is no space. They seem to form blocks themselves. The other thing is, Morandi's bottles seem to be more or less like members of a family.
Yes.
I mean,
and
they're children, they're adults, and they
they're going to grow old together.
Yeah. So there's a kind of human frailty about his paintings. I think Bailey's paintings are a resistance against that.
Well, a reference to it, yes?
Well, you can't avoid the fact that Bailey paints pots and Morandi does too. But on the other hand, if you ask Bailey, what is he painting? He's saying, I'm not painting pots. I'm painting an ideal disposition of pots. I'm painting pots ideally disposed on a surface. And that's what interests me, the revision of what you experience here is a perfect painting, everything in its right place, and you turn to the next painting, there are the same objects in different positions, and yet perfect too. But I don't think that's part of Morandi's concern. I think he's concerned with the rightness of the painting, but I think he's trying to urge an identification that the viewer might have with the pots. The viewer sees himself more easily within a Morandi than within a Bailey.
Mm-hmm.
A Bailey is a spectacle. A Morandi isn't.
That's very good. It really does seem to me that that's true, and that the Morandi is in some way moldy or fuzzy. You know,
Well, it's much more painterly. They apply paint in very different ways. Bailey tries to conceal his brushing technique. And Morandi, when you see the strokes of paint, they only add to the frailty, the provisional nature of everything.
I'm speaking to Mark Strand right now about a set of artists who I feel have some relation to the work of Strand, mm-hmm. which it seems to me also seems to be about a certain kind of set of strokes attitudes, arrangements of words and cadences, so that no matter what enters the poem, the result, in a strange and indeterminate way, is still Strand.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this happens over the years. You write and write, and lo and behold, all your poems sound like you. You depend on certain moves, or you depend on certain resources you have, which become identifiably yours. I will say this, that neither Bailey nor Mirandy evidence much or evince much in the way of humor in their work, whereas I tried to, I don't know whether to use the word infuse or infect my work with humor.
But you don't think that in the mere repetition, the oddness of the project, that although there is not humor, that is to say, jokes within the work, that the staggering variety of it and the limitations of it is in some way implicitly comic?
Well, I think that the variety or the changes are so minute.
Yes.
That they become, they become cataclysmic. I mean, what they do is tend to revise our notion of what is shocking in our world. And once we're involved in a Bailey, say, and we notice those changes, they become larger and larger. And they become incredibly more resonant than the violent changes we're likely to witness on TV. But I'm not sure that it is humor, because here again, they are so grand. They do change shape, but I'm not sure that that's the source of much in the way of ha, 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 you know.
Now, you've published a collection of your essays, The Weather of Words, and it seems to me that in the nature of the collection itself, the pieces, sometimes in their haphazard nature, their sprightliness, their brevity, seem to say that these forms are not important to you, as, for instance, one feels they were in The Necessary Angel important to Wallace Stevens. Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, Wallace Stevens was an intensely formal man, and I think I'm rather informal. I try to write well when I write my essays, but their shape may leave something to be desired. They're given initially as lectures, which I maybe go over. I went over some of them for the purposes of this book. But, I try to... I mean, Wallace Stevens impersonated a philosopher a great deal of the time and spent a lot of time imitating Valerie. I mean, I'm just trying to speak as plainly and as directly as I possibly can to the reader, avoiding any diction that might smack of a particular discipline. I don't use literary terminology. I certainly don't use philosophical terms. I don't allude to many other writers unless they're the subject of the talk. That's not true. In some of these essays, they cover a great deal of time. I do, because when you're young, you want to enlist the support of your elders and betters as frequently as possible.
Oh, my goodness. You're reminding me. Ashbery was once preening in front of a group of young workshop students who were meeting him for the first time, and he said, I know how it must feel to meet your elders and your betters. And someone asked him, who were your elders and betters? And he said, well, Whiston was my elder. But who were your elders and betters at that time?
Well, almost everybody. I mean, beginning with Lowell and Bishop and Berryman and Stevens and Frost and Auden and Eliot, and then John Ashbery, James Merrill, Donald Justice, you know, just all the way up. Even my contemporaries, I consider my elders and betters. Certainly Joseph Brodsky and Derek Walcott are my well, Joseph was younger, but better.
I wonder if you would read your elegy for Brodsky, which comes from the book A Blizzard of One, winner of the Pulitzer Prize and recently published in paperback by Knopf.
Well, Joseph is a very good friend of mine, as you know, and I still miss him. I have pangs of missing him. And for me, well, for him it was a terrible tragedy, but for those who remained behind, who were close to him, it's a terrible tragedy too. In memory of Joseph Brodsky, it could be said, even here, that what remains of the self unwinds into a vanishing light and thins like dust and heads to a place where nothing and knowing pass into each other and through, that it moves, unwinding still, beyond the vault of brightness ended, and continues to a place which may never be found, where the unsayable, finally, once more is uttered, but lightly, quickly, like random rain that passes in sleep, that one imagines passes in sleep. What remains of the self unwinds and unwinds, for none of the boundaries holds, neither the shapeless one between us, nor the one that falls between your body and your voice. Joseph, dear Joseph, those sudden reminders of your having been, the places and times whose greatest life was the one you gave them, now appear like ghosts in your wake. What remains of the self unwinds beyond us, for whom time is only a measure of meanwhile, and the future no more than etc., but fast and forever.
Mark Strand, reading from A Blizzard of One, a poem for Joseph Brodsky on his death. These certain kinds of tributes have really been epical moments in your poetry, your poem on the death of your father.
Yeah.
And in a peculiar way, this poem, too, has something of a gathering up. Are you able to respond to these deaths close to the event? At what point does it become possible to write?
Well, the long elegy to my father was written over the course of 2 years, and I began it 2 years after the death of my father. And the Joseph's poem I began pretty close after his death. And I just felt I had to write it. Most of my poems tend to be elegiac, but they're not attached to a specific event or person.
But to a feeling of loss, an ongoing loss.
Yeah. But these are the only two that I know of where particular people are cited.
That feeling of the loss of the self, which seems to have generated so many of your poems,
mm-hmm.
and is only in a way tangentially related to death. It's almost as if these losses of self are preludes or pre-indications of death.
Well, it's a long continuity that finally culminates in death. I mean, we experience the loss of moments, we experience the loss of hours, we experience the loss of almost everything. I mean, in fact, one might consider that the experience we gain in life, we gain in exchange for time. so that we're spending all the time and gaining something that we can't keep track of. And poetry is one of the ways we keep track of what we're given for time. And it does record a loss, by and large. I mean, some poets would disagree, but I think that the character of most lyric verse is elegiac. And I think it's one of the ways we have of accounting for the fact that we've been alive.
Now, in the case of Bronsky, like Nabokov before him, it was inevitable that loss was also loss of country. You were born in Canada on Prince Edward Island.
Yeah.
Do you feel that to be a source of loss in your own work?
No, I didn't spend enough time there. And when I left, I was an infant.
Oh.
I really spent my first 4.5 years were spent in Montreal. And most of my summers until I was 12, were spent on St. Margaret's Bay in Nova Scotia, near Halifax. I have kept that landscape or that shoreline in my mind all my life, partially because I was very happy there, but it also seemed a fitting backdrop for whatever it is that I wanted to say. I don't know why that should be, but I think... I became a poet looking at that shoreline, those islands, those trees, something. I think I meditated on what I saw, even though I was a child and didn't know that's what I was doing. But they became fixed in my psyche, powerfully.
I've been speaking to Mark Strand on the occasion of the publication, more or less simultaneously, of his collection of essays on poetic invention called The Weather of Words, published by Knopf, and the republication in paperback of A Blizzard of One. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swanick. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse, what time?
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.